Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey guys, this is SupDoc. Thanks for joining us. And we have a very special SupDoc show today because we have our producer, Will Scoville, joining us.
Hey, how's it going?
And co-host George Chen is here.
Hey, everyone.
And what we're doing is we're actually having just an informal discussion about some of the documentaries that we've seen lately, and we want to talk to each other about them.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be just a hostful episode. what we've got going on is, I don't know... You want to tell me about something that I haven't seen.
Yes.
And I'm going to tell you about something you haven't seen.
Right.
And I think that's like, you know, the way the show can go. Usually it's not like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And by something you haven't seen is a doc. And I want to talk about the 2015 documentary, Finders Keepers.
And what's the problem there?
I got a human foot.
Have a what?
A human foot. And it's from nasty, got me grossed out.
I'd seen the grill and ended up buying it. And I opened the grill up, and there's a foot, you know, five toes and five toenails.
Has a 97% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
The preview is amazing.
The preview will suck you in. It's a really good documentary. It's classic because it's good versus evil. It's rich versus poor. It's a guy who wants to be a famous actor and a comedian versus a guy who's gone through a lot of personal problems.
Okay, so just watching the preview, it starts with a guy gets a leg in a barbecue grill at a storage unit,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Okay, so how does that lead to a guy being a comedian and everything else?
Good question.
About?
Well, so I'm going to call him our hero, but our hero he buys a grill through a like a sale. Like, so essentially, his name's Shannon Wisnant. He bought a grill through a storage locker sale.
Yeah, just like that TV show, Storage Wars or whatever.
Oh. Yeah, like Storage Wars. He bought a grill and he got it home, and when he opened the grill top, boom, there was a leg in there.
Okay, now describe that.
Not a leg, like a human leg.
A human leg.
Yeah, describe what is it like? Preserve, is it like mummified?
It is, because okay, so it's such a crazy story. So, we'll backtrack a little bit. The guy who owned the leg previously, his name is John Wood. This is all takes place in North Carolina.
Now, did he own the leg or was it his leg?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah. A little from column A, a little from column B.
Do we own ourselves?
Well,
does the government?
Alan
own us?
Watts would say no.
Yeah.
We're like a leaf coming out of a tree.
Is that the LSD guy?
Alan was, yeah, he's like a Western philosopher.
I call him the LSD guy.
Yeah. Or is that you're thinking of,
not a different Alan?
Yeah, you're thinking of the...
Alan Sherman. Alan Sherman.
Jewish guy, Alan Sherman.
My name is Alan Strickland Williams.
yes, you are. Anyway, so...
Human leg. Let's get back to it.
John Wood is flying with his family in a plane, and they get into a plane accident, a plane crash. And he loses his leg in the plane crash. He wants the leg to remember the plane crash... And because his dad, his beloved father, died in the plane crash, and he blamed it on himself. John wanted to keep the leg in kind of remembrance to his dad, and John's also was going through a lot of drugs and alcohol problems.
Okay.
So he wanted, he had the leg was amputated. He asked the doctor if he could get it back. He wanted to keep it like you would if you lost your tooth as a kid. And you're like, I want to put it in a jar. So the doctors gave him back the leg, but it wasn't preserved. They gave it back to him like in a Ziploc bag.
A raw leg.
Just a raw leg. Yeah. And so John preserved it himself, his amputated leg. He was filling it with like formaldehyde himself with like a syringe. So then fast forward, John has to put all of his stuff in a storage locker because he becomes homeless, basically, because he's got such a troubled life. Yeah. I mean, the plane crash, his dad dying, everything else.
Painkillers.
And he
stuff.
Grew up fairly privileged. Mm-hmm. Like, his family were fairly well off.
Was it a private plane?
Like, well, it's a private plane.
Yeah, so it was just him and his dad in it?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple other people, but his dad died.
His dad's the only one died.
And so he had to put everything in a storage locker. Then he became kind of homeless and stuff, and he forgot to pay the rent on it. And so they sold the storage locker. He'd kept it in the barbecue grill because it would drain, and it would drain into the barbecue grill.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
So it's... It was one of those ones with the So, long comes Shannon Wishnant, who grew up poor in the hollers of North Carolina, and he bought the barbecue grill. And when he brought it home, he opened it to find a human leg in
right.
it. So John, or Shannon rather, had always fancied himself a would-be actor or a comedian, and he always knew he was going to become famous. He always knew it, right? Mm-hmm. He saw this leg as his ticket, his leg up, if you will, his ticket to stardom, and started basically having a roadside attraction with it. So it was like, come see the leg. He became known as the leg guy.
So was there like a news story, like a local news story about him? And then he kind of, okay.
There were many news stories about him. And then he also had like a website and stuff, and he became known as the leg guy. Mm. And it was like adults $5, children $2, wow. and you'd go into his garage and he would show you the leg. And then basically John Wood wanted his leg back.
So he saw it like on a news story or something. It was like, oh, that sounds like the storage unit I gave up.
Yeah, and he wanted his leg back. And
now, are these guys living in the same town, or?
Yeah, right around. They know each other from even from back in like, as kids. Because at one point, Shannon, the guy who gets the leg from the grill, is saying like, "Well, John Wood had everything. His family was rich.
Yeah,
they had planes, they had horses. You know, they had everything you're gonna need." And he just thought it was like, you know, heaven sent to him, and that it was gonna be his way to get out of poverty and obscurity and into stardom, right? But it becomes this like this parallel between the two, because Shannon grew up, you find out that he had a really hard childhood. He grew up really poor. You know, John had everything, grew up kind of rich. And then there was this mix, you know, they changed places.
They flipped. They did a Aykroyd and Murphy.
Right. And yeah, they did. Yeah. And it's great because this documentary, it's one of those kind of documentaries I love so much. I love slices of Americana, and you don't get more slices of Americana than this documentary.
A literal slice.
Yeah, indeed. A literal slice. And it's funny. It's kind of gross. It's sad. It's funny. It's touching. And it's also like has many different struggles between rich and poor, and in how the media plays into it too. I mean, they at some points they go on talk shows. They even go in front of Judge Brown.
Oh, really?
Go to L.A. And Judge Brown says that John Wood should have his leg back. So John gets his leg back, and the story unfolds from there. And it's by the guys who, like Ed Cunningham, who did King of Kong.
Oh
wow! Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which that's Love interesting because that movie is like all about two rival personalities,
and class.
Really.
Yeah,
and so does this play out with like putting one personality against, because it sounds like what's his name who found the leg has that big personality. He wants to be famous. So does it play on that?
It sure does.
Okay.
It sure does. Wow. Well, and at one point he gets hired to be on a reality TV show and he's very excited because this is a guy who grew up basically in a trailer park in the back areas of North Carolina, wants to be famous and wants to be a comedian. He gets called up by a Hollywood production team and they come to where he's at. But they make him a fool.
Yep.
They play him for
a fool.
Yep.
Of course they are going to.
Yeah. And so they have him trying to auctioneer a replica of the famous leg from A Christmas Story. You know, the lamp leg? Yeah. Fragile? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so they show him holding it up and trying to auction it off. And he realizes then that they're just playing him for a fool.
Yeah.
This reminds me that I just got a storage unit and I have to make sure that I have the payments up to date. Because that's always been like, I haven't had a storage unit forever. There's a whole, I got broken into. There's a whole reason of why I have a storage unit. But yeah, I was just like, when I've seen Storage Wars before. And like, this is when I saw the preview, I'm like, well, there's going to be a serial killer involved in this. This is much more upbeat than that, but it also sounds like not really. It's like, it sounds like, I was thinking it was going to be this like murder mystery thing.
Right.
But it's even weirder. Okay. The guy whose leg it is actively participating in the story.
And there's a great twist at the end, like all great documentaries. Well, I won't share here.
Don't spoil it.
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. I don't want to spoil it. And it's great. It's a great documentary. I recommend it to people. It's on Netflix.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Great. Finders Keepers.
That's awesome.
Well, the first time I saw Leon, I liked to come unglued because he had long hair and I wasn't used to it.
What do you think about long hair now?
I love it. My husband's growing it and I'm falling in love with him again because he's got long hair.
I think that's everybody's their own business.
I know, but you look awful cute with your long hair.
A couple months ago, when it was in theaters, caught A Poem is a Naked Person, which is Les Blank's, it's a posthumous release. He filmed it in the mid-70s, and I guess 75, 76, and it sat around for 40 years, didn't get a release. And I'm not totally sure why. It sounds like a lot of it was because it's about Leon Russell, the musician, and there's a bunch of people in it, like Willie Nelson's in it. A bunch of people make appearances. So it might have been an issue of getting rights clearances.
Maybe.
And I didn't know so much about... and Will, you know more about Les Blank than I do.
Yeah, I mean, I know he was around that Leon Russell... Because Leon Russell had that Oklahoma connection.
Oh, okay.
Which is where I'm from. He's from Tulsa.
Uh-huh,
Oklahoma City. But, like, he was a well-known... You know, well-known...
In Bay Area.
Yeah, but he was...
Oh, you're talking about Leon?
Leon, yeah.
Yeah, Leon.
But Les Blank had that, and I haven't... And so this is about Leon Russell specifically, or...
It is following Leon Russell and his band on tour in the mid-70s, and it's this kind of interesting... I'm like, is it going to be this total bacchanalia, probably? Mm-hmm. And I didn't know much about Leon Russell's music. Les Blank, I kind of know from like going to like Down Home Music in Albany... El Cerrito. It's this old-timey music store.
Yeah.
They have a lot of his DVDs. He has a lot of Bay Area connections. And you know, he did a lot of documentaries about kind of Americana and food culture.
Well, he lived in Berkeley until he died recently.
In 2013, I guess, and he passed away.
They just released a box set through Criterion of a bunch of his shorter stuff.
Uh-huh.
I think it had like Gap-Toothed Women and the one about garlic.
The garlic one, yeah.
Garlic, yeah.
And then, but in there is one called The Maestro, which is about a Berkeley resident who used to come into the coffee shop I work at.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know who he was. I just thought he was a crazy dude.
So you've seen The Maestro.
I eventually watched it. It's on Hulu right now. And it's
cool.
Incredible. So it's like a half hour.
Mm-hmm.
I get to see old Berkeley before I ever moved here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's
old Berkeley.
Yeah, and he's a really interesting character who's still sticking around. And
yeah.
He's a very Berkeley character, which I appreciated.
Well, all I know about this is Les Blank's son, Harold Blank, who also is a filmmaker and art car enthusiast, worked on getting the clearances for this for years.
Uh-huh.
So it finally saw light of day posthumously for Les Blank. But a lot of people say it's like his finest work. A lot of people, he considered it his masterpiece in his own personal mind. It's just a lot of like slice of life stuff happening on a tour, and also just like the decadence of a 70s tour. It's not like there's a lot of stuff where the camera crew is like in there.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about like how we just did Gimme Shelter a little while ago and how this is like also I mean, the Stones have such... Well, that's a very... It has a very dark ending, obviously. Well, Gimme Shelter does.
You can also compare the kind of disaster that was in Gimme Shelter to the kind of disaster that was Fitzcarraldo, because he did Burden of Dreams as well.
Right, yeah. Les Blank did that, yeah.
So, like, that is also kind of...
He's attracted to chaos, it seems like.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
portraits. Like, and, yeah. yeah. He's like a portraiteur. Of a
yeah. I would say
but the Maestro is not chaotic at all.
No.
It's actually, it's a very like uplifting portrait of someone who's very interesting. And,
yeah.
And there's really not anything bad
about
him.
There's a lot of characters in this movie. It is Leon Russell's whole crew, but there's this guy who's an underground artist named Jim Franklin, who's just painting this swimming pool. And like they're building a recording studio. There's it gives you like a flavor of the time and like a very southern kind of flavor of the time. And because when I think of like that period of like 70s, 60s rock, I just tend to gravitate towards like West Coast.
Yeah.
But I didn't necessarily like learn a lot about Leon Russell as a person, but.
So it was more about not necessarily his life and career.
It's not.
Just like this specific time.
It's completely like, it's kind of fly on the wall, but also like involved.
Right.
Like they're, like you see the crew a lot of the time.
Right.
They all seem like they're just kind of hanging out together.
It was kind of a style then too in the mid, early the mid 70s. Like those documentaries all seem to have that kind of style.
Yeah.
Where you see the crew, you see them talking to the subjects, you know.
Yeah.
Like they're really involved.
There's a lot of weird like side things, like they go to a wedding, like I think one of the band members gets married in the middle of it, and then just there's like a little kid who sees a camera and starts singing to the camera. There's really good concert footage, Leon with like this, you know, American hat on, American flag hat.
Classic.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I think I need to look at it in a whole as an example of something in the entire Les Blank canon to really see how it fits in. Like, why did he identify so strongly with this one? And it might just be that it was this, like, kind of white whale thing that never got a release. And that he, you know, he's just like, oh, the best thing I ever did. No one's seen it in my lifetime. And I you know, saw it in a theater and I enjoyed a lot of it. And I was like, I'm glad I'm getting to see this thing that's been held back for like 40 years. But I didn't necessarily feel a strong emotional attachment to it because it's not like music that I... It's hard with music docs. If you don't care about the music that much and you don't care about the story too much, it's just like a lot of snippets of things. So I think worth watching, but like some of the praise for it, some people... This guy, Alex Papademos and Grant Land said it was the greatest documentary... Greatest rock documentary he's ever seen.
Wow.
He says comparable to Don't Look Back or Cocksucker Blues. So, you know, I would say even if you don't know much about Leon Russell, it's like good as like a slice of life of like the mid 70s and what rock and roll life was like. I don't know. I felt kind of neutral about it. Like, now that I'm talking about it, I feel like it was more just like the fact that it had been held back for so long.
Yeah.
Piqued my curiosity.
What propelled you to watch it?
Because it had been, I'd seen these write-ups about it, and it was in a theater. I watched it in Berkeley on a Friday night. It was just like, I was just like wondering what it was going to be like because it had so much hype built around it.
Right. And can you see this on Netflix or anything yet? Is it?
I don't think you can yet. So it got Janus Films reissued it.
All right.
And it's...
Okay. So it might be...
Because
I know Criterion has been... They have a relationship with Janus and then...
Yeah.
And then they have released that big set of Les Blank documentaries.
It should have a DVD release,
yeah.
I believe. But yeah, not knowing a lot about Leon Russell, maybe... Maybe I don't know. I feel like it maybe like kept me from like fully appreciating it all the way. Are you a Leon Russell fan?
Yeah, I like Leon Russell. Yeah, yeah.
And you heard anything about this documentary for years?
No, I've never heard. The only time I had heard about it is when the Cine family, Jody,
did the screening.
Did the screening about it?
Yeah,
and it piqued my interest then, but I had never heard. I am a big fan of Les Blanks, but I've never had heard about this.
I think I just need to, it makes me want to check out all the other stuff he's done. There's definitely a lot of weird interviews with people, like just side interviews with people that aren't in the band or just like audience members or just seeing the crowds. And I find all that stuff more interesting anthropologically in a certain way than... and the performances are great too, but I find that stuff really interesting. So I think for that reason, it's worth checking out. But not being, it made me appreciate Leon Russell a little bit more.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love the, he did the, Leon Russell and Elton John did that album together, which I always thought was great.
Yeah. We saw Elton John. At Outside Lands.
Yeah.
Oh, did you guys stick around for that?
Yeah, we saw... Yeah, Will went home, but when we interviewed Dan Deacon, we got to see Elton John for free.
Yeah.
And it was like listening to the radio very far away.
Yeah.
And everything was projected on a giant screen behind
him. He seemed like everyone's favorite English aunt.
Yeah.
Like, he Aunt Gertrude.
He played well. His voice was great.
Was amazing.
I just felt like I didn't need to be there. I felt like I might as well listen to this
recording. That's how I feel about a lot of big rock concerts.
You know, like, I got to say, Dan Deacon's show, he really, like,
amazing.
He's such a live performer, and he just integrates the audience into his into his act. Yeah. So that was my takeaway from Outside Lands. Not that we're reviewing Outside Lands, but...
So would you recommend people see a poem?
I got to say, it felt a little long to me, but it's like watching a music thing about a musician you don't particularly know anything about can be hard. I would still recommend it because it is. I don't know. I think I'd still recommend it as a slice of the 70s in rock culture.
And so the full title
is A Poem is a Naked Person.
Poem is a Naked Person. Cool.
There was, of course, an individual by the name of Andreas Strassmeyer, which came out through the news. There was an association with Timothy McVeigh, where they had met in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and both of them, I think, discussed ideology and had some similar views. But as far as an actual overt act with Andreas Strassmeyer, there was no identification to that effect.
Well, what do you got for us?
And this kind of, unfortunately ties into some stuff that's going on now with the Planned Parenthood shooting that just happened.
Right. Yeah.
I grew up in Oklahoma City. I was there when Timothy McVeigh blew up the Murrah Building. My bank was in that building. Oh. I'd been in that building many times. My dad was a garbage man at the time, and he worked on the cleanup. My father-in-law was a fireman who was one of the first responders.
Wow.
So it's a very, personal thing and part of my growing up. That I found this documentary on YouTube called Terror from Within. And it examines the larger white supremacist terrorist organizations, homegrown domestic terrorism in the United States, kind of going through the 80s and the 90s and kind of wrapping up with the trial for Timothy McVeigh.
Interesting.
Do you know what year this one came out?
This came out in 2002. And now this was by Jason Van Vliet, who did the Waco, A New Revelation, which I have not seen yet. I hear that's pretty interesting, too. But this one, what really got me into this was not necessarily the stuff about Oklahoma City, which really wasn't the focus of the whole thing. It was the development of this one main terror cell that was happening in, I think, southeast Oklahoma, through the 80s and into the 90s. And they talked about how there were these, it was some white supremacists, some Christian extremists who were kind of using this campground in southeast Oklahoma as like a military style training base. So when you're thinking about an ISIS style training camp, this was exactly the same thing, just for domestic terrorists in my home state while I lived there, which is kind of freaky. And they talked about a previous attempt to blow up the Murrah Building in 1985. Now this is all coming from FBI sources, journalists, and this is all public record now. And the thing that they're really, the kind of thing that they're trying to tie up at the end and saying, like, this is the unanswered question is, who is John Doe number two? That's kind of what it ends up being. Okay. But the journey there is really what's amazing.
John Doe number two is, like, working with McVeigh? Or
well, John Doe number two is, there was three people arrested for the bombing of Oklahoma City. Timothy McVeigh, who actually set the bomb off.
Right.
Terry Nichols, who was the co-conspirator, and Michael Fortier. Who he and his wife, actually, I guess four people were arrested. Michael Fortier and his wife mm-hmm. knew it was going to happen, but didn't do anything to stop it.
Okay.
And they were friends with McVeigh and Nichols. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of witnesses. The FBI did release a couple of sketches of this John Doe number two,
okay.
who was not Terry Nichols, who was not Michael Fortier, but was somebody else who they have, to this day, never caught.
Mm-hmm.
This tries to connect Timothy McVeigh and the bombing of the Oklahoma City or of the Murrah building
uh-huh.
with this training camp through this specific person who was working at the training camp mm-hmm. as basically the head of military operations. They're trying to say this might be John Doe number two.
Right.
There is not enough evidence to say that he is. So it's but the whole journey and the kind of unraveling of what was going on behind, you know, this very well-documented rise of right-wing terrorism within the United States. Like a major informant for the ATF was this debutante from Tulsa who had gotten into far-right neo-Nazi stuff, was at this camp in Oklahoma. There's video footage of her there that they show in the documentary.
Video footage of from the camper's point of view? I mean, who shot the video?
It was a recruitment video from this camp, which they have also recruitment videos that look just like ISIS recruitment videos. It is insane.
Yeah,
like their faces are covered, they're yelling at the camera, but it's all in English, which is incredible.
Old school, yeah.
She had been raped by a prominent member, went to the FBI. They said, why don't you become an informant?
Oh.
And she did for a long time. Wow. So a lot of this information was coming from the ATF and the FBI saying, we got this information from her. We have corroborating evidence. So it is not a conspiracy theory documentary,
it's a lot
of these like Loose Change and stuff kind of end up being. It is these are the facts. This is a question that's still open. This may be the answer, but we don't have enough evidence to look at that. And it's
let me ask you a couple questions.
Sure.
For those, I mean, we're talking 20 years ago, 1995, right? There's probably people who are going to be listening who don't know what the Murrah building was. So can you explain?
The Murrah building was a federal building that housed several federal offices. My credit union was in there, which is why I would go in there. And it's kind of strange. My dad helped build the building when he was in construction. He helped take it away when he was a garbage man.
Oh, wow.
So it was a federal building and the FBI, I believe, FBI was further in town. The CIA, I believe, had an office there. I think ATF had an office there. It was chosen specifically because
They're anti-federalists.
This is a certain building away from somewhere like New York or something that housed enough offices of federal agencies, a variety of federal agencies.
Right.
That they could do some damage to those offices.
And unfortunately, they also had a kinder care. They had
a daycare on the first floor,
yeah.
basically right by where the bomb,
it's just horrible. The
epicenter of that. So Timothy McVeigh loaded up a fertilizer bomb in a Ryder truck, parked it in front, and blew it up.
Right.
And it was, and if you
like remotely, yeah.
No, he lit a fuse like while he was in the car, and he got the hell out of there. Yeah.
Yeah, and he did. He got the death penalty.
He did. He's dead. Yeah, yeah. They killed him.
What about the other people? Did they
Terry Nichols is in Supermax right now, along with like the guy, the Olympic Park bomber, and the Boston bomber, the recent Boston bomber.
Oh,
they're all they're all in Colorado together, hanging out at Supermax.
Jeez.
Wow.
Yeah, so
I like how back then there were the militia. Remember, like they would call them the militia. Like,
yeah,
there
and
was even the Michigan militia. That
yeah, there was a lot of Montana
to.
And stuff.
Yeah,
yeah.
But now,
well, I mean, that you saw a big kind of like, oh shit, these people are out there, and this was kind of this was before 9/11.
Yeah,
this is.
There's already been one attempt on the World Trade Center in
93. Yeah, but this, like Oklahoma City, until 9/11 was the biggest domestic terror attack.
Yeah,
or biggest terror attack on American soil.
It's still, it was a white dude.
It was a white. It's still number two.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was still horrible and destructive. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I'm saying is, like, back then it was they're the militia, but it's like they're a terrorist organization.
Essentially,
them what they are.
And you know, you had a whole bunch operating kind of in the Midwest and the South to varying degrees of organization and what they were doing. There's one organization they were talking about called, I think, the Sword and the Arm.
And they're all like white power.
A lot of them are white. Yeah. But again, it's like kind of
tangentially.
The ones that were, you know, a big focus, they were like hardcore. They were going after like abortion clinics or colleges, you know,
liberal professors.
Yeah, more. There was a Jewish talk radio host who was murdered in his driveway by a group of white supremacists.
Oh, is that the thing that Eric Bogosian movie is based on?
Yeah, I think
it might
so.
Be.
That
yeah,
might be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that character. Yeah.
But yeah, it kind of directly connects all these crazy things that were going on. The 1985 Murrah Building attack was prevented by, they were going to shoot a missile at it. They were building a missile to shoot at the Murrah Building.
It's like a cartoon.
From across the street. And the guy who was making it, it blew up in his hands.
Well, good.
And
I like the incompetence of terrorists sometimes is what stops them, you know?
Yeah.
You guys have seen the Weather Underground documentary, right?
It's I haven't seen that one yet.
It's kind of like dealing with that thing from an opposite ideology.
Yeah.
But it ends up kind of being... Right. By default, some of the similar... Well, part of the thing with the Underground is they intended to not do... They didn't intend to have human damage. And actually, the thing that got them caught the most was when their own bomb blew up.
Okay.
In their own compound.
Right.
But...
Well, and there are things where objects and not people.
Yeah, they would try try to do a bomb building in the
just
night,
destroy property.
That was a major distinction.
Yeah, that's a big difference. I do remember now in your research... After what do you? I remember, like, I think Barry Levinson was going to direct.
Yeah, Barry Levinson
about the bomb.
Yeah, it was. Barry Levinson. He's either from Oklahoma or his
Baltimore, right? I thought.
Or his mother lives there. There is a connection.
There's a connection.
Okay.
I always remember my mom would always.
Yeah, because I remember reading, because it's always intrigued me, because I'm old enough to have, I mean, I watched the Waco burning.
Yeah.
I was in college, and I was watching it all happen, and I obviously remember Timothy McVeigh and the Murrah Building bombing, and it's always kind of interested me, and I remember when reading stuff about Barry Levinson wanting to direct a movie about
it. Oh, yeah, I just found an AV Club article from 2011. He's going to make a movie called OKC. It maybe just never went.
Yeah,
and it's kind of unfortunate that, you know, a lot of this international stuff has you know, as tragic as it is, just there's that kind of stuff is happening in the United States as well.
Well, you see
with
a lot
different
of
different ideologies. It's white people, so
well,
they get the press.
The whole thing is it's a lot of it is very similar ideologies, but they're coming at it from different, like,
absolutely,
like Christian versus Muslim, but their goals are a lot of times
similar,
like almost identical.
Yeah.
So
well. You could say the biggest threat the United States have comes from within.
Absolutely.
You know?
Terror from within.
Oh, the script that he was working on, I guess, was written by Chad... the screenwriter's name, Clay Wald, and there was a clerk in the building named Chad Wald, who was his brother. So the brother wrote the script and did a lot of investigative stuff to put, you know, to add stuff into the script.
So would you recommend... Terror from Within?
I highly recommend it. It's just it opened up a lot of information I didn't know about. It's fascinating to see. You know, this came out I guess a year after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
It is a way to digest what is going on with stuff happening internationally because it is a homegrown terrorist cell organization attack. You can kind of see how you can kind of get an idea of how these kinds of things can build up and really, like, ISIS, they say, you know, what percentage of ISIS is, you know, what percentage are they of the greater Muslim worldwide community? Well, what is the percentage of white supremacists to the greater worldwide white population of the world? It's fairly small, and I think it's similar with ISIS. Mm-hmm. But they can be also be very destructive, which is the whole point.
And we don't have a lot of screenings for, thankfully, actually, in a whole nother political ideology rant, screenings for people within our borders, you know, like, so it makes it a little more you know, mischievous, if you will.
Yeah.
I'm certainly...
Yeah, I stumbled across it on YouTube. I don't know where to find it. I'm interested to see the Waco documentary that this fella did.
Yeah.
If it's anything like this one was, because just watching it, I watched it twice and got new stuff out of it both times. It's very dense with information. A lot of people talking, a lot of people who are directly connected to either these organizations or the investigation or writing about it for Foreign Press. It's very good.
Well, way to make me look bad on my own podcast, Will. I'm just like, oh, there's this movie about a rock star. Like, I'm dealing with, like, solving internal domestic terrorism.
Well, you know what? There is a thread here. We all had Southern documentaries with Southern subjects, right?
Yeah.
So from a lost leg to a Southern rock singer to domestic terrorism.
This isn't the only kind of documentary I watch. We were talking about
that's usually not even the kind of documentary we... I mean, I feel like someone's going to pick Loose Change. Like, we're going to talk about...
I'm surprised that it hasn't happened.
I haven't even watched that one yet.
I've never watched it.
I heard about what it was about. I was like, give me a break.
I watched it. I was interested.
I feel like there's going to be someone who's going to do it, though. Yeah. Someone's going to pick it just to be like, let's just do the weirdest thing.
Yeah, I guess so.
Kind of show, you got to dig deep in those kind of things. Well, I think this was great. And to wrap up, I did Finders Keepers, and I would recommend it. I thought it was great. You can find it on Netflix.
I did A Poem as a Naked Person. I'd say you got to be into rock documentaries to really like this one, or you got to be a big Les Blank fan.
Yeah. A Terror from Within. I would search it out on YouTube or any other place you can find it. Legit. It's very good.
It might have a virus attached to it.
Maybe, who knows?
You never know. Well, thanks, guys, for listening. I hope you enjoyed this. This was fun. I'm sure we're going to do this again.
Yeah, and keep checking subdocpodcast.com. Review and rate us on iTunes and any other podcast app that you use.
All right.